Hi, this is William R. Coughlin. I am the director of The Big Lie That Solves Everything. First thing you'll notice is my Maltese Falcon statue, which I try to get into just about all of my pictures, serving as a stand-in for the award statue here. And that is also my brother Ken as the voice of the MC, and later the voice of the boss on the phone. The boss's office, which you'll see momentarily, was just an empty room in a completely empty apartment that Brody Burks, one of our production assistants, was in the process of vacating. And we thought that might make a good location for someone who was speaking to a disembodied boss, implication being that it's a god or some other deity that he's talking to on the phone, also enhanced by this little god light shining down on the phone whenever it's seen in picture. The effect was mixed. I liked having the empty room with just the carpet and the table, but unfortunately it didn't really provide a lot of background for the scene, so it doesn't really make for very interesting shots visually, though it does story-wise sort of create the image I was going for. The genesis of this project started out where we were coming off a fairly decent success of a screening process where we had won an award for Best in Genre for the National Film Challenge. And we decided that at that point that we wanted to challenge ourselves a little bit more. What if we could do two movies at the same time for the 48-hour film project? Started out mostly as a joke until we hit on the idea of actually having the two movies interconnect. That really seemed like it would be a challenge that was worth pursuing. There would be some reason for doing it other than just giving ourselves more work. We started to take a look at the cast and crew that we had available and realized that we could probably pull it off. Jeffrey Long would come back down to produce for me from MIT, where he was studying at the time. He had produced a screening process. He also was able to put us in contact with Andy Rosa, the composer who lives in Chicago and was able to write all this music for us. And then another director, Nello de Blasio, would take the second picture, for which Bjorn Munson would produce. I had worked with Bjorn on screening process and then a short film Bystander, for which I provided some production assistance there. Most of the regular crew we sent over to Nello's team just because he was an experienced stage director but did not have a lot of experience directing film. And I would work mostly with people I hadn't worked with before. Jesse Ochtenberg, the director of photography on Bystander, the short film that I mentioned before, came on board my team here. And then the other main anchor person, I suppose you could say, would be Stuart Scott, who plays Suleiman bin John, or Solomon Johnson. We'd worked with him largely as an improvisational actor. He works with the Washington Improv Theater. And so this was the first film that we'd given him where we really had a fairly well-scripted part. And the first scene we shot him into was that long opening monologue. And he sat down, memorized the lines very, very quickly, and was able to deliver the performance there that we were hoping for. We really did fill out a lot of our cast with non-professionals, but people who had, though perhaps limited acting experience, had a certain presence or a certain character that I wanted to bring to the picture. The woman looking for paint is, of course, my wife, Pam Coughlin, who has gone from being an actress in some of our earlier pictures to a producer on some of our later films. This was actually shot on our wedding anniversary, so she got a special happy anniversary note in the end credits. The man asking Saul for the part is Leland Hedges, co-worker of mine. This hardware store was a location that Brody had gotten for us. He was sort of working on both teams, sort of helping coordinate the efforts of the two. And this was one of the possible locations that he had worked out beforehand. It sort of informed our story writing process. The film genre we were going to work with was fantasy, but we decided against doing something more traditional, either sword and sorcery type fantasy or large magical creatures. And then our writing team on Friday night came up with the idea of a genie who is having to work in the regular world. Kitty Borschelt, another non-professional actress, but somebody I'd worked with in my day job on a creative project. I remember at the time she was sort of accosted by some of the people who were watching this, wanting to get autographs and other information from her. I think she found that amusing. The bakery location here, the audio that we had was largely incomprehensible. And so we went ahead and had the actors come back in and re-loop all of the dialogue here. Unfortunately, we couldn't get the lights off in the hardware store. It was all fluorescent lighting, which made color correction afterwards a bear to try to get this to look halfway decent. Still not sure we did as great a job as I really would have liked, but that was sort of the nature of shooting in a found location. Sean Felty is the character, Ryan Mullering, who crosses over from one film to the next. He's actually purchasing a breath mask here that he will be seen wearing in Quite Contrary. He had shot his scenes for that film first, then came over to shoot ours, so he was able to really gives a little more of insight into exactly how he'd played the character in the other film, let it cross over to ours. Pretty much this whole thing was shot in just one day in the Mount Pleasant area of Washington, D.C., which gave us a lot of different areas to shoot in, a lot of different environments, and overall proved fairly filmmaker-friendly for us. The actor playing the salesman is a man named Tim Randall, who has also helped write this, actually works in marketing, fantastic comic timing, creative sensibilities, and I really wanted to work with him here for this. We didn't really give him much of a stretch. As a marketer, he was playing a salesman, but we still relished having him in the role. The restaurant scene is actually not shot in a restaurant. It's just shot in a living room, actually. We tried to get the lighting to work properly to make it look like it was sort of a booth in a restaurant. I actually had our assistant director run out with a camcorder and just sort of sneak it in his palm and just walk into a restaurant and just stand around and try to capture as much background audio as he could. The nighttime walk scene here, we were really losing light by this point. If you look closely, you'll notice that cars driving by have their headlights on, the streetlights are on. Where it really presented a problem for us was in the focus, which we were just not able to get enough light into the lens, and we had to open the aperture way up and just weren't able to get much depth of field. But we were trying to follow focus as best we could, but unfortunately, they did slip out of focus at the end of their little walk there. Another drawback to this shooting the scene as we were losing light was we didn't have the opportunity to do anything else. There was no way we could go back in and take additional takes because we were just really losing light rapidly. We also had to do a lot of work in post to brighten it up, which unfortunately added a lot of artifacting to the image, but those sorts of compromises are par for the course for 48-hour film production. The song by Scott Andrew, The Big Lie That Solves Everything, was the origin for the title. When we wrote the script on Friday night, we didn't have a title for the picture. And then Jeffrey Long, the producer, and I were driving back home that evening, and we knew that we had access to Scott Andrew's library. And so we started playing songs and really liked the way this fit in. So we ended up naming the picture off of it and then rewriting some of the closing dialogue to sort of tie into the theme of the big lie as well. It took a little bit of time to get that right, but we really wanted to have both the voice transformation effect and something glowing in the eyes to sort of really drive home the point of exactly where the salesman comes from and what team he's playing for. And the shot where the car drives off, of course, is almost completely dark at that point. So we had just one take we could get to that, and trying to color correct that to match the other footage is iffy at best. The pullout shot from the hardware store was shot on Sunday morning. As we were deep in the edit, we sent Jesse back out to try to get another shot of that. We'd tried to get one in the evening, but again, the lighting was just completely gone by that point, and we really could not get a good shot. It's a little disingenuous in that you can actually see somebody behind the close sign in the window there, but one can imagine that he's somebody who's trying to find somebody to replace Saul. One thing we learned early on was if you're going to have a long set of credits for a short film, you'd better do something interesting with them. So we really spent the time to try to create a sort of a scroll work look to it. One of the problems with short film is, as you'll usually be screening these with several other films, the audience is tired. They're ready to move on, so you really don't have a lot of time to run credits. So if you're going to do something, you'd better make them interesting. Well, that's The Big Lie That Solves Everything. I hope you've enjoyed it. If I'm ready for this